The massacres in El Paso and Dayton have sent shockwaves around the country, and we've been hearing from you.
I'm tired of living in a nation where we report so much horrific news without any acknowledgement of how much grief and trauma is affecting everybody.
I'm miles away. My heart and soul is falling.
We're not even free to go to Walmart or send our kids to school without having a drill.
Also on the show, mass casualties through the eyes of the doctors who take care of the victims. And we examine how much power law enforcement could have in the wake of these two shootings. This is The Takeaway. I'm Tanzina Vega. This weekend's tragic mass shootings in El Paso and Dayton were not isolated events. In the past week alone, six other mass shootings took place in communities across the United States. That data comes from the Gun Violence Archive, which defines a mass shooting as any incident involving gun violence that injures four or more people. But for survivors of gun violence, the mental and physical recovery process tends to last long after the media coverage has moved on. It's an issue that was echoed by emergency room doctors in Dayton this weekend.
As far as the aftermath, there's certainly going to be some emotional issues afterward as we find out more about who these individuals were in their place and roots in our community. It's going to become harder. I think we rely on each other first and foremost. I think peer support is what is most called for here.
I have two guests with me now who have worked closely with survivors of gun violence. And a note to listeners that we're going to be talking frankly about some pretty graphic situations. Dr. Megan Ranney is an emergency physician, and she's also the chief research officer for AFFIRM Research, the American Foundation for Firearm Injury Reduction in Medicine. Welcome back to The Takeaway, Dr. Ranney.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
Also with us is Dr. Carol North, a professor of psychiatry at the University of Texas Southwestern Medical Center. Thanks for being with us, Dr. North.
Thank you.
Dr. Ranney, let's start with you. When someone comes into the ER with a gunshot wound, what is the immediate response that they get from personnel?
Well, listen, we train for responding to gunshot wounds. It's part of, honestly, the bread and butter of emergency medicine. We often, but not always, know that someone's going to come in beforehand, and so we very quickly gather a team of emergency physicians, trauma surgeons, respiratory therapists, social workers, nurses, and we go through a protocol to do our best to save that person's life. It's almost a checklist of A, B, C, and we stop at each point of it to make sure that we're doing the next thing that's needed to give that person the best possible chance of surviving.
Now, you said this is a part of the practicalities of learning the basics of emergency room medicine. But in many of these cases, when we're talking about mass shootings in particular, there are often multiple victims coming in at the same time. How does that change the response, if at all?
Yeah, sadly, that is becoming an increasingly common reality in emergency departments across the country. For many of our emergency departments, we have backup, but it becomes challenging if you're in a smaller hospital, a smaller setting. It's a topic of a lot of discussion among emergency physicians and trauma surgeons. How do we appropriately triage and take care of patients in these mass casualty settings? And then, as I know we're talking about today, how do we deal with the aftermath?
Let's talk a little bit about the physical effects of a gunshot wound for those of us who have not experienced this. Dr. Ranney, what are generally the physical effects of a gunshot wound on the body?
So it really depends on what you are shot with, how often you're shot, and where those bullets land in your body. In my clinical practice, I've seen everything from a graze wound on the hip from a hunter who accidentally discharged his weapon to gunshots to the head from people who commit suicide to multiple gunshots to the chest and belly that lacerate the liver, the lungs, the heart. It can be absolutely physically devastating. You can also have very minor injuries if you're lucky. But the mental and emotional wounds are the things that are tougher to see.
Let's turn to Dr. North to talk a little bit about that. Dr. North, you have dealt with and spoken to survivors of mass shootings. What do those conversations tend to focus on outside of the physical impacts of this? What are the mental long-term impacts? And tell us what those conversations tend to focus on.
Well, when we do our research studies and talk to people, we're interested in understanding what kind of experiences they had in the event and afterward, and what kinds of psychiatric problems they might develop. The most common psychiatric disorders that develop are post-traumatic stress disorder, or PTSD, and new episodes of major depressive disorder.
Tell us a little bit about those conditions specifically. How do they manifest in victims of mass shootings?
Post-traumatic stress disorder is a disorder with different types of symptoms, including intrusive memories that may be manifest as like flashbacks or nightmares of the event, and hyperarousal symptoms where you're jumpy and have trouble concentrating and too wired up to sleep, and then avoidance and numbing symptoms for those people who go emotionally numb and can't deal with facing reminders of the event. Major depressive disorder involves a lack of interest in pleasure, low mood, maybe crying, trouble sleeping, loss of interest in eating or pleasurable activities.
And Dr. North, how soon after an event like a mass shooting do those symptoms begin to manifest?
The symptoms can begin very quickly, within hours to days on average. And most of the people who develop these symptoms will recover from them fairly quickly, within days to a month. But people who continue to have symptoms or accumulate more symptoms over a period of a month or more might then have a diagnosable disorder.
Dr. Ranney, going back for a minute to the physical recovery process here, when we see, a lot of us aren't able to see in what's happening behind the emergency room doors here. For some, and a lot of the time, the cameras and the reporters move on after an event like this. But for many of these victims, the process is just beginning, isn't it?
Absolutely. Again, it really depends on how you're shot. You know, some people we send home from the ER if, again, they just had a graze wound or it's a minor flesh wound. But others spend weeks or months in the hospital and then go to rehabs and may never have a normal life again. You know, in my clinical practice in the emergency department, we frequently take care of people who come in for complications of gunshot wounds that they experienced months or years or even decades earlier.
And Dr. Reddy, I'm curious, when we hear medical personnel talking about these incidents, often in press conferences that are put together moments, if not hours after the event, the doctors themselves often, even though they're prepared for this, the gunshots, and they're prepared, and this is, as you said, their bread and butter of what they do in the emergency room, what is the element, what is the mental toll that this can take on medical personnel who are handling this, especially if they're getting large amounts of patients at once?
Yeah, that's a great question. It is tremendous. I'll tell you, in my role as chief research officer of a firm, one of the things that has most stuck with me is the stories that I've heard from my colleagues across the country. I think knowing that it's okay to talk about this and that I'm a safe space, for lack of a better word, I've heard a lot of stories. Some of the most affecting stories are single gunshot wounds, you know, a pregnant woman who's shot by her partner or a young man who shoots himself. But these mass casualties, they just stick with people. My email inbox right now is full of folks who've lived through this and get re-traumatized when they see that their colleagues have to go through this again. You know, but because of HIPAA and our culture, it's not something that we talk about a lot. We're expected to kind of put it aside, and actually part of our training, part of that protocol is meant to stop us from having kind of an emotional reaction to the patient and the injury in the moment. We're so focused on saving their life, we don't have time to have feelings, right? They could distract us from our life-saving work. And there's not necessarily time built in to mourn afterwards. You can take care of a horrific gunshot wound, and then you have to walk out and go see a patient who has cold symptoms or chest pain in the next room, and you can't let it show. It's an area that we're looking a lot at and trying to create support for.
Dr. North, I want to ask you here, is that where the psychiatric and psychological services can come in to fill the void, to provide that type of empathy and understanding to victims of gun violence and survivors of mass shootings?
In the very short term, crisis counseling can be quite helpful, and there are some procedures known as psychological first aid that can comfort people and help them through the early periods. And later, as symptoms turn into psychiatric disorders, standard treatment for the psychiatric disorders can be very, very helpful.
And we've seen research that indicates that memorials and vigils that we often see communities pull together are actually helpful for survivors. Can you expand a little bit on why that might be?
Well, one of the most helpful things for survivors is to be able to be with other people who have experienced what they have experienced, to share what they've been through together. Also, bringing together your loved ones and sharing with them or spending time with them, feeling safe with them, can be very helpful. But not everybody can talk about it or face it right away. Sometimes it takes time. But for people who can, sharing and talking things through and processing things can really help get them through it.
And Dr. North, some of your research has also looked at the positive effects that can happen further down the line for survivors of mass shootings. How is that possible? Can you explain that?
Well, right away, there really isn't too much positive, although you can be struck by the outpouring of altruism and love from people in the community. But as time goes on, people can start to find resilience and experience resilience and find strengths perhaps that they didn't know they had. And people may experience love from other people that they weren't aware of otherwise. There are many positive things that can come about. And many of these things are things that communities can do to bring about positive things to help the whole community recover.
And Dr. Ranney, in terms of the coverage of gun violence here more broadly, and specifically when it comes to mass shootings, are there areas that you see that the media can improve, particularly when it comes to how we are reporting on casualties, names of victims, or anything that happens behind the ER doors?
Absolutely. So don't give notoriety to the shooter is first and foremost. Provide resources to help people cope with the trauma, both folks who are secondarily traumatized by hearing about this and for the communities themselves. And also don't forget that there are 100 deaths and 200 injuries that happen every day across this country. The mass shootings are really the tip of the iceberg, and we're committed to finding solutions for all of it. I think our nation right now needs hope, and you and the media can help provide that.
Dr. Megan Ranney is an emergency room physician and the chief research officer at Affirm. And Dr. Carol North is a professor of psychiatry at the University of Texas Southwestern Medical Center. Appreciate you both for speaking with me.
Thank you, and I'm pleased to be with you today.
Thank you. It was my pleasure.
On Monday, President Trump addressed the mass shootings that shook the country this weekend.
We have asked the FBI to identify all further resources they need to investigate and disrupt hate crimes and domestic terrorism.
And just last month, FBI Director Christopher Wray testified that most arrests made this fiscal year have, in fact, been domestic terrorists.
A majority of the domestic terrorism cases that we've investigated are motivated by some version of what you might call white supremacist violence.
Devlin Barrett is a national security correspondent for The Washington Post, and he joins us now to talk about President Trump's remarks and address just how realistic his calls to action are. Devlin, thanks for being with us.
Sure. Thanks for having me.
So let's start with what Trump was calling for in his remarks. Let's give one example.
First, we must do a better job of identifying and acting on early warning signs. I am directing the Department of Justice to work in partnership with local, state, and federal agencies, as well as social media companies, to develop tools that can detect mass shooters before they strike.
Devlin, how realistic is it, as Trump is suggesting, to do what he just laid out with the DOJ and federal agencies and social media companies? And whose job is it to act on these?
Well, it's primarily the FBI's job when you think about the national effort. But look, it's not as if the FBI and other law enforcement agencies aren't already trying to do that. It is very difficult, you know, to get in front of every mass shooter. Now, there are many success stories. There's no doubt. You see all the time, frankly, instances where someone's, you know, grandmother or schoolmate or somebody comes forward and helps point cops in the direction of someone that they're concerned about. But that doesn't catch everyone, obviously. And Trump, what the president is saying, that he plans to push them to do more in this arena. And I think you will see a more aggressive effort in this arena. But obviously, that is not a perfect system by any stretch. And, you know, most counterterrorism officials would tell you they already work very, very hard on that front.
Well, let's talk a little bit about that, because we heard at the top FBI Director Chris Wray testifying that many FBI investigations over the last year have involved white supremacy. Is the FBI funded for this, Devlin? And is there anyone there who's specifically in charge of domestic terrorism?
Yeah, so this spring, in an effort to have a more centralized focus on the problem of domestic terrorism specifically, this spring the FBI stood up what's called essentially a domestic terrorism fusion cell. Now, in some ways, that's not a huge change because the local joint terrorism task forces around the country have already been chasing suspects in both the domestic terrorism front and internationally inspired terrorism. But the idea of the fusion cell is to get more of a headquarters focus, more of a top-down focus on this issue. So they are making efforts along this line. But I got to tell you, I speak to current and former officials who are concerned they're still not doing enough. They're still not focused enough. And their concern is that part of the reason is that this is a politically fraught subject, because there is some concern in some quarters of the government that if they push too hard in this space, it will become a political football.
Devlin, the president also talked about the role that social media can play in identifying, quote, early warning signs. And I'm wondering how that would work. We heard a little bit about this after the Department of Homeland Security was implemented following 9/11. Is this going to mean that law enforcement is scouring Facebook posts? And if so, there seems to be a fine line here between surveillance and national security.
There is a fine line, and the FBI is the first to tell you they do not investigate ideologies. That is not what they do. And in the past, in historically speaking, when they have done that, they've gotten into a lot of trouble for doing that. So there is a fine line here, and even law enforcement doesn't like to define exactly where they draw the line, because they think that might be too helpful to people who are planning violence. But look, the point is they key in on talk of violence. And to the degree that people are talking about violence specifically, they will focus in on that and start looking at people who do that. The challenge that a lot of investigators have in the terrorism space is that, particularly when it comes to domestic terrorism, what they say they see a lot of is people spewing hate in places like 8chan and other online forums, but not actually – those words not actually crossing the line to say, and someone should die or someone should be hurt because of that. What they see is a lot of hate, and they don't necessarily see a lot of people talking about violence. The other part of that problem, as described to me by investigators, is that a lot of people say a lot of nonsense on the internet. And figuring out which ones mean it and which ones don't is a big challenge of their work.
The president also mentioned red flag laws, and particularly GOP leadership seems to be thinking that this is a good way to go. Can you explain what they are?
Right. So a red flag law is essentially a state law. It's important to understand that when the president and members of Congress say they support red flag laws, what they're saying is they support states adopting these laws. And what a red flag law does is it basically makes it possible typically for the relatives of someone to report them to the police and say, we are concerned about this person's mental state. We'd like you to take their weapons away from them while they seem to be going through problems. And it essentially makes it easier, an easier mechanism for a judge to say, okay, we're going to take this person's weapons away because their relatives have reported them as possibly a danger to themselves or others. That is what a red flag law does. And the reason why Republicans are embracing this is because, you know, for Republicans, there's often a desire to look for anything other than gun control legislation in the wake of horrible attacks. So obviously Republicans talk a lot about mental illness. The president said in his public address that, you know, mental illness and hate pulls the trigger, not the gun. And that is very much in keeping with the Republican perspective on these mass shootings and gun violence. And so when you talk about red flag laws, it's another way for Republicans to say, we're not going to look at guns. We are going to look at mental health. And we are going to push those decisions down to the states, because the reality is in a lot of states, it would be fairly difficult to pass red flag laws. And you're basically pushing that responsibility down as opposed to up to Washington.
Devlin Barrett is a national security correspondent for The Washington Post. Devlin, thank you so much.
Thank you.
The shootings in El Paso and Dayton have dominated news coverage this week on this show and on other outlets throughout the country. The breaking news cycle around these tragedies can feel familiar, but that doesn't mean it's any easier to hear.
I don't even know why I'm calling. I was listening to the radio and just started crying in my car.
On Monday, we asked you to call in and tell us how you were processing the news of these two mass shootings that have killed more than 30 people. And some of you admitted that it's been really hard and that you're afraid.
You know, I'm miles away and my heart and soul is falling to bits as I look around at the country that I immigrated to that I no longer recognize. Thanks for allowing me to vent and to let those people know they're strangers that are 1,000 miles away that are feeling their pain.
My name is Jennifer, and I'm calling from Portland, Oregon, and I'm tired of living in a nation where we report so much horrific news without any acknowledgement of how much grief and trauma is affecting everybody and how it's numbing us.
Hi, I'm Natalie, and I'm calling from Florida. I feel afraid of going out now. There's a Woodstock celebration in my area, and the first reaction I had was, well, I can't go there. I might get shot. So I think I'm just going to stay home and play some good music instead.
Some of you want action after the shootings. You called for more gun regulation and also new political leadership.
Howard from Cape Cod. Until America gives up their love affair for guns, nothing's going to change. The politicians need to vote to take the automatic weapons off the street.
Hi, this is Gina calling from Brooklyn, New York. I've just been in a panic all day. Physical panic. I really don't think we can change any right-wing gun owners' minds. I think the only thing to do is vote them out. I think all the energy that we're spending online trying to convince these people that they don't need assault weapons is a waste of time and better spent trying to elect someone else.
We also heard from people who were frustrated by the coverage of the tragedies.
Hello, my name is CK from Charlotte, North Carolina. President Trump spews hate every time he opens his mouth, and the Republicans refuse to speak up against it, and the media has to broadcast every foul thing that that man has to say. Somebody's got to break the chain.
Hi, this is Bill from Redding, California. You know, like anyone with a heart, I feel the deepest sorrow for the families and friends, but I also feel great anger. I'm angry towards the Democrats and the Republicans and even the news media. The news media sensationalizes these events and advertises those pathetic people who commit these horrific acts, who are looking for recognition, and they get great notoriety from being seen on the news.
And still, some of you told us that these mass shootings feel like an attack on the core values of the United States.
My name is Valeska, and I'm calling from San Diego, California. You know, it's really hard because we live in the land of the free. That's one of the first things that we say about our country. And now, we're not even free to go to Walmart or take our kids to a festival, or send our kids to school without having a drill and knowing the exits.
We want to thank everyone who called in. This is a very important conversation, and we need to keep it going. To share your thoughts or tell us how you're processing the news of these mass shootings, you can give us a call at 877-8-MY-TAKE. You can tweet us at The Takeaway also, because we always want to know what you're thinking. And we end the show with some sad news today. Novelist Toni Morrison passed away Monday night at 88 years old. One of the most celebrated writers of the 20th century, Morrison forever changed the landscape of American storytelling. Her work, centered squarely on the Black experience, garnered every major award, including the Pulitzer Prize in Fiction, the American Book Award, and the Nobel Prize in Literature. Here she is on PBS in 1993.
I'm not going to give up one drop of melanin in order to get there. I'm not going to erase my race or my gender to get there. I want all of it. I deserve all of it, and we all do. I don't want to be blanded, bleached out in order to participate in this country and walk any hall of power or corridor that I want to.
The world is saddened by her loss and grateful for her immeasurable contribution to our culture. We'd love to know what your favorite work by Toni Morrison is and why it resonates with you. You can tell us how on Twitter, we're at The Takeaway, or you can call us at 877-8-MY-TAKE. Thanks so much for listening. I'm Tanzina Vega, and this is The Takeaway.